26th episode of Radix's podcast, which we've renamed Good Copy, Bad Copy.
Nice.
I'm Emily King, Radix's marketing executive, and today I am joined by Fiona Campbell-Howes, Radix's founder.
Hello.
In this episode, we're going to be discussing the current trend in marketing towards millennials and what it means for B2B copywriters and content creators.
So, Emily, I've seen lots of different definitions of what actually constitutes a millennial, lots of different age ranges. Mm. So in your view, what do you think is the millennial age range?
Well, the one sort of age range that I've seen mostly quoted, and it's the broadest range, but it seems to nobody can be bothered to define anyone else within that age range. So it's the millennial or Generation Y generation is mainly considered to be those born between 1980 and 2000, which is a pretty big window.
That is a pretty big window.
Considering the changes that have happened in the world and society and technology in that period of time, it's pretty big. And this is the group that most sort of like analyses seem to sort of go towards, or they might go a little bit further into the 1980s, but not by much.
Right. And so so just to be clear, that this group includes you.
Yes.
And does not include me.
Yes.
I'm your classic Generation X.
Apparently
person.
So.
Yes. Yeah.
And there's been a lot of discussion because I suppose people have suddenly realised we're in jobs. I've been with Radix now for like 3 years and I know I influence things that happen in the business.
Absolutely.
And obviously it's becoming a case across businesses worldwide that people in this age group are becoming involved in business decisions, which is why we need to start thinking about them.
Yeah, that's right. And I think B2B brands do seem to be just catching on now that the way they need to market needs to change because this age group has a very different attitude towards content and technology. And this age group, as you say, is now in a position now to start making or influencing business decisions.
Just to throw some numbers in, Google Research found that 46% of B2B researchers are now millennials. Mm-hmm. And that 81% of non-C-suite have say in purchasing decisions. So you really do need to be thinking about the age group in terms of like how to approach content.
I think a lot of the articles we see haven't so far been very helpful in this regard, because I think a lot of articles about millennials are written by crabby Generation X people like me, and it's all like, oh god, these people are so self-centred, you know, yeah, they can't focus on anything for more than a second.
Apparently everyone's read that Joel Stein Time article from 2013, which was titled Millennials, the Me Generation, and everyone stuck around for the opening bit where it was like, oh yeah, they're self-obsessed and lazy, and they didn't stay around for like the concluding paragraphs where he kind of said, oh yeah, by the way, they're pro-business and financially responsible.
And by the way, we're all lazy and self-obsessed as well, and there's no actual difference.
Yeah.
But we have, you know, we might have got that out of our systems now and had a bit of catharsis about all millennials.
You say I keep seeing articles cropping up on various sites that kind of just hash out the old stereotypes, and you've got to look to people like IBM who've kind of gone out there and gone, actually, here's a bunch of myths, exaggerations and uncomfortable truths about millennials and how they compare to Generation X and baby boomers. And there's not many differences.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of borne out in my experience. I mean, I know here at Radix, over half of our massive 11-strong workforce are millennials. And, you know, looking at the way you guys work in the workplace and the kind of things that you do and talk about and are interested in, I don't see that huge amount of difference between your generation and my generation, I have to say. And I think as some of these articles that we've been looking at for this podcast point out, the difference is down to the technologies that have been available to you, as opposed to the technologies that were available to us when we were younger, and the way that's helped you kind of shape your view of the world.
I mean, just to show how this sort of 1980 to 2000 split for millennials is perhaps too broad. Obviously, yourself, you remember the web before 99.
I do.
Yeah.
I remember the days before the web.
And what it was like. But the problem is like, so you had a millennial who was born in the middle of the 90s. They would have been too young, really, to remember what the internet was like before web 2.0.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody like myself, I started school, like secondary school in the mid 90s. We had IT classes and the school was just starting to introduce people to the internet. So I remember what crappy internet design used to be like, and how user interfaces and UX, it was just horrible. I remember all the badness. In fact, I'm old enough to have had a primary school that had a BBC computer mm-hmm. as well. So I remember bad design, and it's something I'm just so... Design is just like really important to me as a millennial, basically, because of how bad UX design used to be. And I just don't want to ever see anything that harks back to it, ever. Even, you know, it's just, no, keep it away. But then this means that when I come across, like, say I'm looking at, oh, it was just such a thing when we were looking at CRM software last year. Mm. And I knew I was going to be spending a lot of time with it. And anything that I saw that just had design that looked a little bit too close to Windows 98 in how it looked, I was just like, I don't want to know. I can't deal with this. It just brings back bad memories, usability problems, past traumatic experiences. But somebody who's like, I don't know, sort of like younger than me, but still classed as a millennial, they won't have those kinds of memories. They wouldn't have had to have wrestled with Windows 98 and a 56K modem and poorly designed products.
No, and probably some of the younger ones don't really remember a world before mobile.
No, they probably don't. I remember what it used to be like not having a phone. Yeah. And it used to be a thing when it was my age, when it was like the age when you started getting phones, sort of like the early 2000s, and so you didn't get a phone until you were partway through secondary school. Mm. And then it was like, it was purely for, are you okay, to the parents, rather than socialising, because texting was so expensive.
Yeah.
And so were calls.
Yeah. And I saw, actually, on the topic of mobile, I saw a really nice infographic the other day, which it was really simple, just had silhouettes of mobile phone handsets and how they've kind of evolved over the years, and the silhouette was all in black and the screen size was in white, so it just really emphasized how the screen size has changed on a mobile handset. And so you could see, you know, these early mobiles, tiny screen, and they're made for calls, you know, for voice calls, whereas just over the years, gradually the screens got bigger and bigger and bigger, and now mobile phones hardly used for voice calls at all. I mean, I doubt many of the younger millennials even know that they can make a call on their phone.
Well, to be fair, if they're a young millennial living in Cornwall, trying to get phone signal to make a call in the first place.
But yeah, it just shows that, you know, how much we've become reliant on using a very small screen to consume content and, you know, to interact with content, which is something that we do need to be bearing in mind now as copywriting and content creators when we're writing stuff.
I suppose one of the big differences that some of the research between millennials and other groups has shown is that Generation X is a bit more trusting of advertising, apparently, in comparison to Generation Y.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure how this difference came about. I suppose it's perceptions of mass media, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I suppose this is the thing, you know, growing up, because I kind of grew up in the 70s and 80s, and the only media was mass media, and it was TV and it was radio, and it broadcast at you, and there was no way for you to do anything or interact with it or change it or shape it or influence it or have your voice heard in any way. So we kind of got used to a world where, you know, you're being broadcasted at, a message is coming at you, and your only option is to absorb it. And so we kind of grew up in that world where we're used to big advertising messages being shown to us, and I suppose we feel more comfortable with that kind of way of brands communicating to us than the millennials do, because you've got, you know, now every opportunity to interact and have your own say and feedback.
I mean, I suppose get going sort of like, because I was over, I would have been around when the switch over from mass broadcast to personalised messaging, sort of like, or not personalised messaging, but being able to choose the messaging you accessed, kind of changed. If you look at the example of TV, like early 90s, VHS tape machines, not as widely accessed in this country as they were till the middle of the 90s. Suddenly everyone had tape machines. Mm. Parents would record TV shows or films they thought you were interested in, and then you'd watch what you wanted, when you wanted, and fast forward through ads. And now, obviously, we've got people have got DVRs. You can't escape advertising with on-demand unless you're subscribed to something like Netflix.
Yeah.
But people haven't had to put up with ads so much. And while there was this brief point just before Web 2.0 sort of became a thing where pop-up ads and banner ads couldn't be avoided, we were all desperate at my age group to avoid the damn things. And as soon as something like ad blocker became a thing, it was like, right, no more ads. No. Mm. And if people wonder why, I mean, millennials don't like certainly online advertising. I mean, according to researcher, only 6% of millennials in the US consider online advertising at all credible.
Mm.
The reputation of ads is really poor because of how badly they've been done in the past, either on an aesthetic level or the fact that there's been so many bad ad rings which have led to issues with malware and stuff in people's systems.
Yeah.
And so it's not trusting because of the amount of times you've had to go and clean up a family member's computer because they clicked on an ad.
Oh, yeah. That and also just the way that they kind of like really insidiously insert themselves and come up with all this trickery to try to make you click on them. So, you know, like a pop-up ad, one that will pop over or whatever they call it, you know, that comes up in front of whatever it is you want to read. Previously, like maybe a couple of years ago, you would be able to like skip ad or close the ad up in the top right-hand corner. Now I've seen ads that have that, they up in the top right-hand corner, skip and go to site. So, and that looks like the only option. So you go to click on that because you want to not see the ad, but then it takes you to the site that the and you've been tricked. You know, why should people trust these things? Because they're tricking you into clicking on them.
Meanwhile, pop-up ads on mobile devices are really horrible and just shouldn't. Don't do that. Don't. It's a really bad design for UX because it even if you give somebody a way out, it always seems to be almost impossible to actually click on the thing to get out of a mobile pop-up ad.
Yeah. Also, I mean, I would say about ads, in the 80s, I think that was probably the heyday of advertising. And ads were an art form. They really were. And you could appreciate them for what they were as a kind of very short or very small piece of art. Whereas now they just seem to be very devious tricks designed to try to get you to click on something.
But then obviously, if certainly with millennials, if we're so mistrusting of ads, that would seem to indicate that what Joe Polizzi and the Content Marketing Institute have been going on for the last few years, that content marketing is the way forward. That would be your best way for approaching millennials and certainly in a B2B environment.
Yeah, definitely. And it's the type of content marketing that we would think of as kind of honest and authentic content marketing. Because, I mean, we've talked before on this podcast about native advertising and how that's really not going down very well with the millennial generation because they can see through it, you know, see through it in ways that maybe older people don't automatically see through the fact that that you know there is a hidden message and a hidden brand behind this piece of content.
I suppose it's this issue of authenticity is a really really big one for millennials. I mean, it's not like something has to hark back to a thing and like a culture or something. There's just this weird. It almost feels like there's just this weird filter we've got where we can just find sort of detect if something's not inauthentic. If I was to personify this in any way. In the last main season of The Last Leg, there's a late night talk show on Channel 4. They came up with the bullshit button, which would shout bullshit in one of the presenters' voices. And they start implementing it when anything seemed inauthentic.
Yeah.
And it does feel like you just kind of like, just this alarm goes off in your head when you see something like that McDonald's ad where there's this older chap and this younger chap and they seem to have these very different lives. And they meet up in the McDonald's. Well, I say meet up. They happen to be in the McDonald's at the same time. And oh, look, they do their same thing with their bullshit goes off in my head. It just feels so inauthentic. And while that's obviously a business to consumer kind of example, I've seen perhaps the closest I've seen anyone try to do this is appealing to like system admins because obviously a lot of system admins are my kind of age. And they've sort of like tried to steal a bit of geek culture or something in order to put together a campaign. And some of these, like, they work really well.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these don't. The ones that feel authentic tend to kind of respect the material that they're obviously drawing inspiration from.
Yeah.
And they don't deviate too far from it. And you know, there's like you know, just a couple of things that they do, which means that it feels authentic and that they understand you and the culture that you've come from and the stuff that feels inauthentic. It's like when people use superhero type sort of like comic snippets or something in their branding and it just looks stupid.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel authentic, it doesn't feel real and the bullshit alarms.
Yeah.
Just going off in my head.
Yeah, and like you say, it's disrespectful to the audience who are much more embedded and know much more about that world than the brand that's trying to communicate to them with a really superficial way of looking at that kind of thing. Yeah. What then advice would you have as a millennial for B2B brands that are looking to kind of break through and seem authentic and honest when they're talking to audiences?
Well, I would like to say that at least among my circle of friends, which aren't all marketers or advertising, they've got everyday jobs and that, we've started to, we're less keen on clickbait than perhaps other age groups because we're just like, oh, they're trying to lead us in. Is it really genuine content? Probably not. So clickbait headlines probably aren't very popular with us at the moment.
So do you think, because, you know, a lot of content marketing is based on clickbait headlines, do you think that that's got a really short shelf life now? Do you think that's going to stop?
It could stop being less popular. I think a lot of what we want is stuff that seems ethical. Yeah. Like, I can't remember the exact figures, but in IBM's Myths, Exaggerations, and Comfortable Truths, they kind of talked about how millennials wanted managers that were sort of like ethical people. And I would say that would probably transpire over to kind of like content as well.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't want something that looks like it's going to trick us.
Yeah, because it's interesting because, you know, BuzzFeed and stuff is still wildly popular. You know, yeah. Massive amounts of clicks. But that's probably because what they promise with the headline is actually what they deliver.
Yeah, that is what they deliver, yeah. So, like, when the BuzzFeed article that I've liked the most this week was about Cheeky Nando's.
Yeah.
And it delivered a proper explanation about Cheeky Nando's.
Yeah.
And it was fine, and I understood that. And, you know, it delivered. But it's when you sort of, like, for instance, The Independent has changed its online content over the last year and a half, and they've kind of moved away from just regurgitating what they've had in the paper so much as writing online-only articles, which have got clickbait headlines. And so often when you click on those headlines and the content inside isn't actually what the headline was about, or, it twisted the original content in such a way that what you thought you were getting, you don't get.
Yeah.
It's just frustrating. So you just click off before you've even seen any ads they might have actually placed around the page, which your ad blocker wasn't blocking at the time.
Yeah.
You're just out of there.
And it's I think, often really difficult for us as copywriters. You know, we write a lot of, for example, email nurture campaigns where, you know, we're taking a whole series of content that the client has created and we're sending out in emails. We're trying to get people to open those emails and look at the content or download the content. So we're trying to come up with, like, really enticing subject lines and headlines, maybe in a kind of BuzzFeed or, God forbid, Upworthy type style. But if the content doesn't deliver against, you can, like, increase the email open rate, but you are going to lower the trust that the audience has in your brand.
And I'm getting fed up with, like, what appears to be mostly salespeople and organisations that have got you on their mailing list, and they'll put they'll have, like, a Ford FWD title RE.
Oh, God, yeah.
And it's like, this is inauthentic because I know I haven't emailed you.
Yeah, it's trickery. Yeah,
and I don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think a lot of these, I mean, I have read surveys where it says that those type of tactics do get your emails open. Yeah, they may get your emails open, but they're not going to increase the trust in your brand.
You know, click-through rate or where's my subscribe?
Or even get the click-throughs, yeah.
You know.
So I think, you know, subject lines and headlines and sort of clickbait style writing is one thing, but what brands need to be thinking about is how to make the content itself appealing to this, like, growing, increasing millennial generation. I know, do you have any views on what kind of styles of content that millennials respond best to?
Stuff that actually reflects back to reality.
Mm.
So, like, customer stories that, again, come across as authentic and they appear to have genuine quotes. And
another big sticking point, yes.
You know, actually tell the truth of a story about them actually overcoming some kind of adverse situation through what they've actually bought. That's really nice and authentic. But also stuff that, content that does respect the cultures that the age groups, like, within. Like, I know we've talked about it before, but the Adobe Marketing Cloud Clicks videos with the gentleman that tries to buy clicks for his quarter. One of the reasons why I really like the video is because aesthetically it's actually incredibly similar to the camera work and lighting that was on Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
So you don't have to necessarily directly reference a culture, but it's bringing in the aesthetics and the design of something that's popular within an age group. Can at least warm them towards it.
Yeah, Yeah. And it's interesting because maybe some of this content is written by experienced writers.
Yeah.
And because they're experienced, they're older. And so they don't have the same kind of cultural touch points and references that this younger generation that they're writing for has. So it's, I think there's an interesting dichotomy emerging there.
But the other thing, though, is that IBM's research showed that Generation X is more likely to solicit peer opinions than millennials. Mm. Mm. But then if we combine that with the fact that 81% of purchasing decisions are done by people who aren't in the C-suite, well, then surely that means that you could have conversations going on between Gen X and millennials. Gen X are talking to millennials, but then it's like, well, which content, who's had the content, which is then being brought up in the conversation. Like, did the millennial read something first, or did the Generation X person read something first? There's going to be a conversation happening across age groups.
Across generations, yes. Yeah. So authentic and respectful content is something that we really need to be thinking about when we're writing for a millennial audience. But what about content formats? Because you see an awful lot of people saying, oh, you know, people these days, they don't have the attention span. They can only cope with snack-sized content. Mm. It's all got to be bite-sized if it's on mobile. I mean, do you think that's actually true?
I don't think it necessarily has to be short. Mm. It has to be well signposted. You have to be able to let people... So you've got a long page and there's a load of copy on that page. If there's no subheadings, no images, no bullets, there's nothing to help people either read a bit at a time, take a break, come back, or skim it first to actually check that what they're about to read is going to inform them in a way that they want to be informed. They need to be able to... I mean, I'll quickly scan a page before I decide whether or not it's worth me reading it in depth.
Yeah.
But unless there's the design elements and the copy elements there to kind of allow for that, then I'm not even going to give it a chance in the first place.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously with a book I would.
Yeah.
But with a web page, suddenly it needs to be scannable in the first place so that I can decide whether or not I'm going to read it. I mean, a lot of people in my age group, certainly who are on the older spectrum, we like sites like Medium.
Yeah.
And obviously that's more about long form content. Mm. But then they'll see there are those design elements that people who write on there do tend to use subheadings and images and blocked out quotes.
Yeah.
You know, to help draw you through the story and give you points where you can pause and reflect before continuing.
Yeah, I think this is really important. I think, you know, all writers should bear this in mind, not just for, I don't know, mobile or smartphone formats, but for any type of on-screen reading format, you need to have that work really signposted and split into chunks that are really well, you know, signposted and with subheaders, so you know exactly where you are and what you're getting. And what about, well, it's interesting to know, say for a long-form piece, would you and your peer group read it all at once, or is it something that you might save to a site like Pocket?
We might save it, or we might have it open in a tab. So, because obviously we're allowed to leave tabs open at work, you know. Yeah. If we come across an article, we're like, oh well, I've got to deal with these emails a minute, but I want to come back to this.
Yeah.
Like, we'll leave the tab open, do some work, and then come back to it.
Yeah. So this is what I find interesting. You know, when people talk about long form content, they kind of assume that someone's going to start reading at the beginning and then read until they get to the end. But I don't think that's how people really interact with content anymore.
I mean, obviously, and then having correct subheaders and signposting going on within the article means that if somebody does take a break from it, they can come back to it and they'll know where they're at and what they'd previously read.
And what about, I think maybe just lastly, sort of interactive content, because this is something that I think we're just starting to explore in B2B now. I mean, a lot of the content that we have been creating up to now is still based on this kind of print world model where you are creating something and you're presenting it to the audience and you're expecting them to read it. But do you think interactive content is something that the millennial generation might respond to more because they're more used to actually participating in the sort of popular cultural content?
They might. I mean, if their actions within the content actually reflect then in the content, then perhaps we do like interactive content. I would say length, actually, interactive content is more of an issue because there's been, if we're going to talk about, say, for instance, video games specifically, and then obviously that isn't marketing content, but as a format, longer form games in video games, the big, well known as AAA titles, are actually selling less and less in most circles. There's like diminishing sales because they take so long to play, and they're also a big investment, so you've got to think about, you know, sort of time over money kind of situation. But then lots of people are picking up mobile games even within the millennials age group, and those are short or you can play a little bit, put it down, play a little bit, put it down. So I would say that with interactive content, like, yeah, people will want to go near it, but you would have to make sure that it's not so long that it outstays its welcome.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that when you're promoting something in the B2B world, shorter there is probably better. Unless you can come up with a like really creative, really engaging, interactive format to draw people in over a long period of time. I think probably that's where shorter trumps longer for content.
Well, that's all we've got time for in this episode of Good Copy, Bad Copy. You can follow Radix on Twitter at radix.com, and you'll find our website at radix-communications.com, where you can also sign up for our monthly e-newsletter for the latest copywriting tips and insights.